Hello, my friends. This is Dr. Beter in Washington. Today is February 24, 1980, and this is my audio letter number 54. Someday, a few years from now, the survivors of Nuclear War I will start asking questions. They will look at the smoking remains of a devastated world and ask, how could this have happened? And why was it not prevented? Perhaps you are one of those unhappy survivors. This message will have been heard first early in 1980 by my listeners. But maybe you are not a 1980 listener. Maybe you found this tape in an attic in 1985 or in a basement in 1990. And perhaps you are playing it now out of curiosity with no idea of what I have to say. My friend, if you are listening to this message someday after Nuclear War I, I am speaking especially to you. Because unlike my listeners in 1980, you who are listening in 1985 or 1990 have the benefit of hindsight, a sense of history. You know that Nuclear War I really did take place. You know that it was more destructive than all the previous wars in history combined. And you also know something which I, speaking in early 1980, do not know. If you are a survivor of Nuclear War I as you listen to this tape, you know who won the war. Did Russia's new rulers achieve their goal of total victory? Or did America's new ruling circles, the Bolsheviks, succeed in their goal of nuclear stalemate with 350 million dead worldwide? As a survivor of the war, you will know the answer to that question. But you will still be asking all those questions about why and how it happened in the first place. My purpose in this message is to give you some of the answers. And in the process, I'm also giving a warning to the few who are already willing to listen today in 1980. It has now been 7 years since I first began going public with my confidential information about economic, political, and military plans. It all began with my nonfiction book, The Conspiracy Against the Dollar, published in 1973 by George Braziller in New York. In the book, I showed how powerful people and organizations were planning to deliberately destroy the United States economy on the way to war. I described how inflation had been set in motion by divorcing the United States dollar from its gold backing. And I explained how this was intended to benefit the powerful few at the expense of all the rest of us. Today, I'm sorry to say it's all happening before our very eyes. To the planners of it all, it is a giant game of numbers on a computer. But for all the rest of us, it's a tragic human story, repeated millions of times over. No one has to be told anymore that something is wrong. We can all feel it in the air. But our leaders are not telling us the truth. And so the people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. I receive countless letters these days which express it all far better than I can. I'm about to read part of a letter I received recently from a wife and mother in my home state of West Virginia. It may sound familiar to you. I now quote, "In my short 29 years of life, the changes in economy seem so drastic as well as swift. My father, a foreman at a local oil refinery, now deceased, made $500 a month. We ate very well, and I was supplied with new school clothes come fall and spring of each year, plus comforts of many toys children long for. We weren't rich, but middle class and comfortable. Now my husband and I make $1,500. We do not own a new car. We do not have credit cards. No charge accounts. Our one asset, our home, is quickly becoming smaller as our three children grow into adolescence. We live from one payday to the next and have had to ask for our parents' help in more than one crisis. I can hardly believe this is possible. In 1970, I had my first car and remember paying 27 to 29 cents per gallon. I constantly worry about my boys and how they will survive their grown-up years. My oldest son will be at the age for the draft in 5 short years, and I fear for his life. End of quotation from my listener's letter. My friends, things like these are the bottom line in what our own rulers here in America are doing to us. There's nothing accidental in all of this. If it were accidental, I would not have had the information to warn about it starting 7 years ago. And our troubles now are only a pale shadow of things to come. The letter that I just read for you describes the beginning of the end of a way of life, the American way. And this month, February 1980, it has been symbolized by the beginning of the end of another tradition, the Olympic Games. 6 weeks ago in early January, the puppetized Carter administration began agitating for a boycott of the summer 1980 Olympics in Moscow. Supposedly, the Olympic boycott would be to punish Russia for moving into Afghanistan 2 months ago. But in fact, the Olympic boycott is only part of a much broader boycott campaign designed to goad Russia into war. And the very Olympic movement itself is now threatened as the first casualty of this United States campaign. The stated target, the anti-Olympic campaign by the White House, is the Moscow Olympiad next summer. But already, the maneuvering for war has whipped up gray clouds over the Winter Olympics at Lake Placid, New York. For the past 2 weeks, Lake Placid has been the scene of Winter Olympiad number 13, and bad luck has seemingly cast its shadow right from the start. First on February 9, the United States soured the atmosphere at the opening session of the International Olympic Committee in Lake Placid. The committee was shocked and outraged by the speech delivered that evening by the United States Secretary of State. His only official function at the session was an honorary one, to declare the opening of the session. But he did not bother to do that. Nor did he waste one word on matters like good sportsmanship, brotherhood, or anything else that the Olympics were supposed to stand for. Instead, the entire speech was a tirade against Russia, demanding that the Summer Games be taken away from Moscow. The next day, February 10, an Aeroflot jetliner carrying 122 Russian athletes bound for Lake Placid landed at Kennedy Airport in New York. But the plane was denied ground service and had to fly on to Dulles Airport outside Washington. From here, the Russian athletes had to make their way back north to Lake Placid by bus. And when they arrived, they were given a taste of the latest in American Olympic hospitality. The Russians were herded into lodgings without adequate heat and with only one toilet for 18 rooms. As the games got underway in Lake Placid, they did so in the shadow of an Olympic ultimatum to Russia by the United States. If Russia did not pull out of Afghanistan by February 20, then the United States would pull out of the Moscow Olympics. The deadline passed without a Russian withdrawal from Afghanistan, and the Olympic movement appears to be on its way to destruction. War talk is now swirling all around us. Like a giant whirlpool, it is spreading wider and wider, sucking in everything around it. The overthrown Bolsheviks from Russia, who now control America, will use anything and everything to achieve their goals. They care about nothing at all but war, revolution, and catching us all in their swirling hell of satanic power. As always, innocent victims are the key to Bolshevik designs. Today, these innocent victims are countless Olympic athletes whose dreams of glory are drowning in the vortex of Bolshevik intrigue. Tomorrow, the Bolsheviks intend for the victims to be you and me by the millions. And it will not be just our dreams which are snuffed out, but our very lives. Because human sacrifice on a grand scale is always a hallmark of Bolshevik schemes for power. Earlier this month, our situation was summed up accurately by an anti-draft speaker to students at Berkeley, California. He said, quote, "We all live in Guyana now," unquote. The Bolsheviks here in America are shutting down our land as they prepare for nuclear war and Bolshevik dictatorship. The threat to revoke passports of athletes who want to go to the Moscow Olympics is only the beginning. Most Americans still do not understand what is happening, but the trap is already closing around us all. My three special topics this month are topic number one, the secret American defeat of January 1980. Topic number two, weather modification as a weapon of retaliation. And topic number three, Russia's accelerating preparations to survive nuclear war. Topic number one, 4 days ago on February 20, the United States Olympic ultimatum against Russia expired. That day, Pravda and the official Soviet news agency TASS said that the Politburo member Mikhail Suslov had given a speech at a town on the Volga River. The speech was actually a collective response by the Kremlin to American actions. The answer to the expiration of the Olympic ultimatum was, quote, "The Soviet people will not be intimidated," unquote. Then, America was described as using Afghanistan as a pretext for blackmail and threats. And in answer to that, Suslov said, quote, "The American government's actions will inflict damage mainly to the United States itself," unquote. The Russians plan to make these words come true, my friends. They plan to let the United States walk into one military trap after another. Each time they plan to let the Bolsheviks here in America believe they are springing a surprise. But each time, the Russians intend to be one step ahead. Each time the Bolshevik dragon shows a fang, the Russians intend to pull it. And so, as Suslov put it a few days ago, the American government's actions will inflict damage mainly to the United States itself. The new Russian master strategy was already at work when I recorded audio letter 53 last month. At that time, I revealed that the Bolsheviks had already set in motion the August 1978 plan for a nuclear first strike against Russia. The secret planners of the American operation fully expected that the operation could lead to nuclear war one before the end of January. But last month I reported that the secret American nuclear strike operation against Russia was already in deep trouble. First, the Israeli-piloted American submersible aircraft in the White Sea and Caspian Sea were blasted out of existence on January 20. I was able to report that to you last month, and so I won't describe it all again now. The important thing to recall is that the Russians had lured the American subcraft into a trap where they were destroyed. And their destruction took place under conditions which prevented the Bolsheviks here from learning about it immediately. As a result, other parts of the American nuclear strike plan were still going ahead. When I recorded my audio letter last month on January 21, I reported that American RPVs were being rushed to Sinkiang Province, Red China. An RPV is a remote control airplane, and those which were on their way to China last month were very special. They were relatively small and hard to spot, very fast, and able to outmaneuver any known anti-aircraft missile. Like the subcraft, the RPVs were essential to the attack plan, which I first revealed in August 1978. When I revealed the attack plan, I also explained how desperate America's ruling circles were to gain access to China's Sinkiang province. This was a geographic key to the plan for using American RPVs to attack Russia's cosmosphere installations in Siberia. But it took nearly a year and a half before China finally agreed to the plan. The breakthrough came during the urgent trip to China early last month by the United States Secretary of Defense. Right away, we started hearing rumors in the news about a military alliance with Red China. Part of the price of the deal was for the United States to afford Red China most favored nation trade status immediately. And so, as his trip to China ended, the White House suddenly started leaning on Congress to act fast. By January 20, China was given a guarantee that it would be passed. And 4 days later, our rubber stamp House and Senate approved most favored nation status for Red China by overwhelming margins. The Bolshevik war planners here in the United States did not wait for the actual vote. They were in a hurry. On January 21, the RPVs were on their way to China, as I reported last month. I can now report that they arrived in Tsingtian Province the same day I recorded audio letter 53, January 21. There were 14 RPVs. 7 were to be launched at Semipalatinsk, where Russia's cosmospheres and particle beam weapons are assembled. The other 7 were to be launched at Novosibirsk, where the operational cosmosphere base is located. And each RPV carried a multi-megaton hydrogen bomb with a cobalt jacket. In nuclear bombs lingo, they were extremely dirty bombs, designed to blanket the target area with a deadly radiation for decades. But last month, I reported that 4 separate Russian commando groups were poised on the border, waiting for the RPVs. When they did arrive on January 21, the Russians waited only long enough to make sure all the RPVs were in place. Then around midnight that night, the Russians began moving in. Just in case, there were also 45 cosmospheres hovering over the area, but they were not needed. The Russian commandos achieved a complete surprise, and it was all over in a matter of minutes. The RPVs were all blown up, and the camp was overrun. In November 1978, a secret Russian missile base in Guyana, about which I had been warning publicly for 4 years, was destroyed. Joint American and Israeli commando forces took the base by storm and killed every single Russian on the base, as I reported in audio letter 40. But last month, the Russians evened the score. Russian commandos wiped out the secret American RPV base in Tsingtian Province, China. And not one member of the joint American and Israeli forces at the base was spared. As the Chinese dawn broke over the smoldering ruins of the American RPV base, January 23 was working its way around the globe. That evening, the latest replica for the late President Jimmy Carter was scheduled to be on television. It was to be a tough speech, setting the stage for war itself to erupt within days. But the Bolshevik military planners here in America were in a state of upheaval. The RPV operation in China had turned into a disaster, so it was obvious that the Russians were now on the alert. The decision was made to freeze all other parts of the nuclear first strike operation to assess the situation. Coded signals were flashed to the non-existent subcraft in the White and Caspian Seas to continue holding at their final checkpoints. At the same time, another subcraft operation was getting underway in the Black Sea. 29 subcraft were involved, and all were ordered to stop in their tracks and await further orders. The Black Sea subcraft operation was not a part of the original plan, which I revealed a year and a half ago. But during that time, Russia's particle beam weapons program has caused additional targets to be added to the Bolshevik first strike plan. 3 of the most important new targets are at Kharkov, Voronezh, and Kazan, as I will explain in topic number 3. The first 2 were to be attacked from the Black Sea. The 3rd target, Kazan, was to be approached from the Caspian by subcraft using the huge Volga River. When the Black Sea subcraft were ordered to halt on January 23, many were still close to their bases in northern Turkey. 11 subcraft were ranged along Russia's Crimean sea coast, but the rest were still in Turkish waters. That presented the Russians with a slight dilemma. As I reported last month, the Russians preferred not to use their most important weapons right now, where they can be observed in action. But it soon became clear to the Russians that the Bolsheviks were getting cold feet and would shortly order the subcraft back to their bases. Soon after night fell across the Black Sea on January 23, the Russian High Command gave the order to attack the subcraft. There were 92 cosmospheres hovering over the Black Sea at that time. Each subcraft was being tracked continuously by at least three cosmospheres using their psycho-energetic range-finding equipment, that is, PRF. When the attack order was given, selected cosmospheres started firing their charged particle beam weapons downward into the sea far below them. Each subcraft was resting motionless a short distance underwater, not nearly deep enough to avoid destruction. And so, each subcraft erupted briefly into a brilliant cloud of steam and debris. Then the sea was dark once again. Chance observers ashore and on ship saw nothing more than a brief, intense light on a distant horizon, a spark that disappeared as quickly as it had appeared. But to the Bolshevik war planners here in America, those brief sparks on the horizon spelled disaster. They meant that all those nuclear-armed subcraft in the Black Sea would not be available for a second try later on. And the Bolsheviks then guessed correctly that the same was true of the subcraft in the White and Caspian Seas. The destruction of the subcraft in the Black Sea took place just after 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, January 23, 1980. A few short hours later, the so-called Carter Doctrine was proclaimed in the State of the Union speech on television. For public consumption, the United States was still talking tough, threatening to use military force in the Persian Gulf. But later that same evening, January 23, it was the Russians who were doing the really tough talking out of the public eye. Soviet Ambassador Anatoly Dobrynin suddenly arrived at the State Department for an unexpected late-night meeting. There he met for an hour and a half with a top-level representative of the Bolsheviks. Dobrynin is famous for the beaming smile he always wears, but he stopped smiling as soon as the meeting began. Speaking with icy precision, he confirmed that Russia had destroyed the American subcraft and RPVs. He also called attention to an unpublicized disaster earlier that day near northern Greece in the Aegean Sea. A hush-hush oil rig, so-called, had been at work under Norwegian and American control, using German and Dutch workers. But that day, the rig had suddenly gone up in flames, killing everyone aboard. Dobrynin explained that Russia had known what the rig was up to and did not approve. It was preparing to plant nuclear missiles on the ocean floor to be aimed at the heart of Russia. The Russians had waited until the missiles were aboard the platform, ready for planting. Then a trio of cosmospheres overhead had destroyed platform, missiles, and the crew all at once. Finally, Dobrynin added something which was intended to drive home the hopelessness of the Bolshevik war plans. He revealed that Russia knew that there was one more element in the overall first strike plan, which was still underway. A tiny force of four more subcraft were moving into the Baltic Sea, armed with cobalt bombs. They were a suicide force, and they were all heading for a single target, Moscow. They were to approach Russia's Baltic Sea coast underwater until they arrived at widely separated points near Kaliningrad, Riga, and Leningrad. Then when the order came, the plan was for them to surface and make the transition to flight configuration. From there, their mission called for them to take off, arming their cobalt bombs for detonation on impact. Flying their super quiet subcraft at treetop height, their mission called for them to get as close as possible to Moscow before being shot down. As each suicide subcraft crashed in flames, the cobalt bomb it was carrying would detonate automatically. The Bolshevik war planners here in the United States did not expect that any of them would actually reach Moscow, but they were confident that they would get close enough to do the job. The ground-level detonation of four cobalt bombs would send an enormous cloud of deadly radioactive fallout drifting eastward, and the Bolsheviks here were sure that Moscow, the nerve center of Russia, would not survive. By administering a giant dose of radioactive poison, the Bolsheviks were planning to turn Moscow into a giant Jonestown of silent death. Dobrynin described it all during the meeting. Then he revealed that Russia was tracking all four suicide subcraft. He proved it by giving their locations. Then he said, "I am instructed to inform you that you are now invited to attempt to save these four machines from destruction if you can. You may try to hide them or protect them in any way you choose. You will discover that you cannot. Promptly at 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time tomorrow, 12 hours from now, they will all cease to exist." The next day, January 24, the Russians made good their threat. One suicide subcraft was near the Russian Baltic coast itself, close to Kaliningrad. Another was well to the west, near the border between East Germany and Poland, where it strikes the coast. The third was far to the north, 30 miles west-northwest of Pori, Finland. And the fourth was clear outside the Baltic, about 70 miles north-northwest of Bergen, Norway. But all four were blasted simultaneously by the cosmospheres hovering in the sky above them. The destruction of the suicide subcraft with their cobalt bombs marked the end of the abortive first strike operation last month. It was a total defeat for the United States, while Russia did not receive so much as a scratch on the arm. And its ramifications are still spreading. For example, the debacle in Sinkiang province was a major shock to China. It has revived the arguments within Chinese ruling circles that the United States is a paper tiger, and the Chinese military commanders who were involved in the Sinkiang affair are in deep trouble. In recent days, reports have begun reaching the West about a major reshuffle in the Chinese military. Russia plans to unseat all of the Bolshevik leaders of China. Meanwhile, my friends, only a few hours ago, I received confirmed evidence about an urgent new development in Iran. The doctors at Tehran Hospital have announced within the past 12 hours that Ayatollah Khomeini will see no visitors until further notice, including religious and political leaders. The doctors say he has been overtaxed. But the real reason, my friends, is that within the past 48 hours, Ayatollah Khomeini was assassinated and replaced by a double. It was the fourth attempt on his life, and this time it succeeded. He was shot above the left eye.